Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Tux Lurzel.
And Stephanie Domingo.
I am coming to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where I am recording on land belonging to the Lenape Nation.
And I come to you from North Canton, Ohio, where I'm recording on land belonging to the Kaskaskia Nation.
These are some nations of many that are still very much out here doing their thing, and we would like to acknowledge that.
Yes. I like that word.
Yes. It doesn't roll off the tongue, but I like the way it flows.
Yeah, it's fun to say.
Yes. So as you probably know by now, Beyond Reproach is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. And as usual, we be drankin' and we be swearing.
Yep.
As you can tell, we are recording remotely today. So we're drinking from different places, but we're drinking the same thing. Today we are drinking a cocktail called a Rob Roy. Okay, so the Rob Roy cocktail is basically just a variation on a Manhattan that's made with Scotch whiskey in place of bourbon or rye. It was named after an operetta that told the story of a great Scottish folk hero who supported the poor. Robert Roy MacGregor was a 17th century outlaw, often cited as a sort of Scottish Robin Hood who led battles against noblemen in the Scottish Highlands.
Sexy.
The operetta titled Rob Roy debuted in New York City in 1894, and a bartender at the nearby former Waldorf Astoria Hotel, which used to be on the site where the Empire State Building stands today, created the cocktail for opening night to publicize the play.
Okay.
Apparently that was like a thing that people used to do in New York, was like they would come up with a new cocktail for when new plays were coming out. As like,
I love that.
Like publicity. Yeah, that's, I was reading that was like common. Some cocktail historians, however, claim that the Rob Roy was actually invented at another luxury hotel, the Fifth Avenue Hotel down by Madison Square, that same night, opening night of the play. But in recent years, cocktail historian David Wondrich has found evidence that a bartender named Henry A. Orful actually created the Rob Roy while working in Hoboken, New Jersey around 1895. A blended Scotch whiskey salesman came in wanting a Manhattan, but according to his own company's policy, he wasn't allowed to drink anything not containing his own whiskey.
Ha!
Yeah. So Orful's solution was to swap in 2 ounces of Scotch alongside the sweet vermouth and Angostura bitters. And Wondrich writes, the drink is good, a name is suggested, and done.
Okay.
Essentially, it's a Manhattan for Scotch lovers. And it never really became quite as popular as the Manhattan, but it was very popular. Popular enough to make it into cocktail recipe books for decades to come. And it was especially mentioned quite a bit in the sort of masculine whiskey-soaked 1940s and 50s.
Okay. I've seen it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've definitely heard of a Rob Roy. I've never had one, though.
Yeah, I've seen it on menus.
So shall we? You ready for this? Take a little sip and a little cheers. Cheers.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah.
It's definitely a little less sweet than a regular Manhattan, because Scotch is definitely more dry than bourbon is.
Yeah. It's really nice.
Yeah.
I was worried it was going to be super smoky.
Yeah, blended Scotch, there's a little smokiness to it, but like it's not like super peaty the way like single malts usually are. So.
Oh, I got a single malt.
Oh, did you? And it's still not that smoky?
No, it's smoky, but it's not overwhelmingly.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think when I sent you the recipe, I specified blended Scotch, but when I was doing
it, had I known, research, I would have gotten that because it was definitely cheaper to get blended Scotch. Totally.
Yeah.
I'm like, I guess I'll have the smallest bottle of Glenfiddich, please.
Yeah, it's very tasty though. I mean, if you're a whiskey drinker, especially a Scotch drinker, you're gonna like this.
Yeah, there's an afterburn with it. Oh, like for an sure. aftertaste.
Yeah, it's definitely of the Scotch. Strong. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the cocktail.
Okay.
The old Rob Roy.
It's so rare that there's a story you tell the history in such a snappy fashion. Mm-hmm. Usually there's lots of lies and drunken people telling tales.
I know.
And it's like, wait, you're done?
Both of my cocktails this month are going to be shorter stories. It's very rare for me.
Yeah. I'm like, wait, it's my
That's
turn
it?
Yeah. What? I'm not ready. I'm going to have a little sip.
Yeah, take another sipsy. Loosen your jaw gums.
Your cocktail looks so much better than mine.
Yeah, mine's in a cute little Nick and Nora glass.
Yeah, mine's in like a weird goblet with like decals on it.
Is it like a branded, like a liquor company glass or something?
No, it's my mom. She loves a theme. Our kitchen has the wallpaper has this, I guess, it's mostly fruit. It's like fruit and flowers patterns. So this has like little, I don't know if you can see, little grapes. And leaves.
Okay. Cute.
Yeah. She's
I love that.
Rosie loves a theme, as you can tell from my surroundings.
Most moms did in that era. Yeah. My mom was really into my mom went through a few different ones for our kitchen. There was a while where we were like, we had like geese or something or ducks.
Oh, okay. And then that's cute.
Yeah. Then she went through like a weird pig or not pig, cow phase where everything was like cow print and cow. There were like cow tchotchkes all over the place. Yeah.
Nope. That's a swing and a miss, Miss Brenda. No, I'm glad she got past that, but absolutely not.
Yeah. Good times.
Yeah. So being back in Ohio has reminded me how much people live their lives for the fucking flag. You've driven through Ohio, right? I think you sent me a picture once of like some rest stop that had all this like Americana.
Oh yes, yeah. And there was like touristy stuff at the rest stop for Ohio.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Ohio is in big promotion mode. It's trying to draw people into the state, and
that they are.
It's kind of funny.
There's like billboards all over Brooklyn about like trying to encourage people to move to Ohio for work.
I, on my favorite podcast, I listened to not one but two different promotions for the state of Ohio in just one episode. It was outrageous.
Yeah. In Detroit, I'm always seeing ads for like tourism in Ohio that's like, come to Ohio because there's like outdoorsy stuff to come see. I'm like, we're in Michigan where there's like lakes everywhere. Like you can't walk 5 feet without tripping over a lake. What are you doing?
I don't know who is running their marketing campaign. It's not the way.
Yeah.
So we are a very flag-centric nation. There are flags on government buildings, which makes sense.
Yes.
Government buildings.
That does make sense.
I don't know, landmarks, but to have flags on like a car dealership, why?
Yeah.
I don't get it. There are flags outside of every school and in every classroom. Flags feel really foundational, but that wasn't always the case. Mm. I'm curious, were you required to pledge allegiance to the flag every morning like I had to in school?
Yeah. I don't know if it was like mandatory, but
it wasn't mandatory.
I mean, like, it was just everybody just did it. It never even occurred to me to try not to.
Same. It was like, this is what we've done since we've been in school. Like, I did this shit in kindergarten.
Exactly. Yeah. So now it, like, if I feel like there are people who are like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yes.
You know,
more and more, I'm going to get into this. More and more people are abstaining from it. It's recently come to my attention that globally, like, us pledging the flag is very weird.
Yeah.
Other countries don't do this.
It's super like, kind of creepy. Like,
it is. It's like, it is
intense nationalism.
Yeah. I never really thought about it until I learned that we are one of just a small group of nations that make their school children pledge a national allegiance every morning. So I thought, I don't know. Growing up, I distinctly remember learning about like the Nazi youth and being like, look at them being so indoctrinated by their oppressive regime. Meanwhile, like I had pledged the flag that day. It's really kind of wild that it's only the US, China, India, Malaysia, North and South Korea, and the Philippines and Turkey that require their students to pledge allegiance every morning in school.
That is
so all nations do have oaths, mostly geared at people who are in public service, people who are in the military. Like, it makes sense to pledge to your nation.
But it's like an official thing that you do once and you're done, right? It's not something you do every morning.
Well, I'm not sure about the military. I feel like they might have to do it.
Sure, the military, I guess, makes more sense, but
yeah, but I think you're right about civil service or even just becoming a citizen. Like that makes sense to have someone pledge allegiance to a new country, but for civilians to do it every day, let alone children to do it every day, it's a little odd. Yeah. So thankfully, in 1943, the Supreme Court ruled that no school or government can compel someone to recite the Pledge of Allegiance or salute the flag.
Okay.
However,
47
states in 2022 require students to pledge allegiance to the flag. There are exceptions. There are a lot of different exceptions. If you are religious or if you just have a note from your parents, it varies.
You can, like,
based
opt
on
out.
You can opt out.
Okay.
But it is required in 47 states, which is pretty wild.
Yeah. What are the three that don't do it?
Oh.
I've stumped ya. Gotcha.
Yeah. It's like weird. It's like Wyoming and shit. Uh-huh. It's like a really weird. I know Wyoming is one of them.
Okay.
But I don't remember the other ones.
Interesting.
Yeah.
See you, Wyoming.
So it turns out this all started with Chicago's first World Fair in 1893. It was the largest World Fair at the time, and it was held to celebrate the 400th anniversary of guess who?
Oh, fuck. No.
Yes.
not this dizzy bitch again.
I know. So I was not meaning to do this. Number one, I didn't know these stories were related.
Yeah.
I was not meaning to do this scandal now. I was going to do it later.
I thought we were done with her.
I know. I had no clue that she was in this. I'm disgusted, but it's actually kind of fitting. Like, of course, everything bad has to do with this bitch.
Columbo.
So my scandal today is the marketing gimmick behind the Pledge of Allegiance. But first, a toast.
Yes.
Toast.
I don't need an excuse to drink more.
Yeah. Let us cheers to existing in one of the most potent propaganda atmospheres on Earth.
Yes. Cheers. I'll drink to that.
It's so ubiquitous, we don't even recognize it.
Yeesh. It's pretty tasty. It's growing on me. It's not my favorite thing that we've ever drank, but it's pretty good.
It tastes familiar. It tastes like a Manhattan.
Totally. Yeah.
So, okay. It is worth noting that the first Pledge of Allegiance was written in 1887 by a Civil War vet named George Balch. It was created in response to the Civil War to educate children on the notion of us being a united country, which made all the sense in the world. I understand why they did this back then.
Yes.
His pledge went like this. We give our heads and our hearts to God and our country. One country, one language, one flag. Yeah. Balch was an educator. He worked for the Board of Ed in New York. He believed in teaching children, especially immigrant children, loyalty to the U.S.
And English language. Yeah. Definitely did not like that
one
language situation.
Right? Yeah. he, as an educator, he wrote a book on how we should be more nationalistic, united. Well,
I get that it was this after the Civil War. And I mean, look where it's gotten us, though.
He didn't know. He didn't know. There's no way for him to know the downstream consequences. Yeah. So he went so far as to write a book on the subject, and he started to work with governments and private organizations to distribute flags to every classroom, or at least every school. That was his goal. Balch's pledge, it predated the modern version by 5 years. So, you know, people had pledges on the mind, and it was embraced by many schools for decades.
Okay.
This dude isn't really mentioned very often because his pledge deviated from the current one. And also, it's stupid. Like you said, the language thing. And the, I give my head and my heart to God. No, I don't. Speak
I mean, for yourself. We also have that God bit in ours now, but that wasn't in it originally, right?
It was not in it originally. That was an ad because of the rise of communism.
Yes.
In the 50s, unfortunately.
That Eisenhower, right?
Correct. Yes. Eisenhower. That bitch who tried to warn us, but then did all these awful things.
Yes.
Like, sir, you can't have it both ways. You can't be warning us of the military-industrial complex and then just being awful and increasing it in your own way.
Yes.
So our modern pledge was believed to be written by, I know that's very convoluted, but I'm going to clarify that, believed to be written by a man named Reverend Francis Bellamy. He wrote it at the request of a man named Daniel Sharp.
Okay.
Daniel Sharp Ford. He was the owner of a popular magazine called The Youth's Companion. Have you heard of this magazine before? Okay. I think it merged into the American Boy, like in the 20s, and that had it was around for like 100 years too. No.
Never heard of that either. If it's not Highlights Magazine, I don't know nothing
about it. Yeah, I know. Same. I think this was like the precursor to Highlights. So the Youth Companion, it was a popular Boston-based magazine that aimed at increasing the moral fiber of young girls and boys. Hmm. Don't really know what that means, but sure. Click, click.
Yeah, they needed to eat more steel-cut oats. They needed more fiber in their diets.
I hope that's what it was, and not like them, I don't know, skinning raccoons and shit. So who was this Reverend Francis Bellamy, and how did he find himself working for Ford and working for this kids magazine? He was born Francis Julius Bellamy on May 18th.
Oh my.
I know.
It's my birthday.
It is May 18th, 1855. He was born in Mount Morris, New York, to a really religious family. His father was a Baptist preacher man. He would become a Baptist preacher man as well. He went to the University of Rochester and he studied theology.
Okay.
And I know what you're thinking. This man sounds like he sucks. He doesn't, actually. He was actually very attractive. So.
Oh, okay. Well, then.
His wiki is a little distracting because he has like really nice hair and like a really big nose. And I'm I rest my case, Your Honor. So, you know, thirst aside. He can do no wrong. Well, he can do some wrong. You will hear about the wrong. Okay. So I was reading through his wiki and I'm like, okay, he's a Baptist preacher, check. He loves the flag, check. Like he's probably the worst. And he really, he's complicated. He wrote a book in 1888 called Looking Backwards. And I'm like, this sounds like fascism. Like he's checking a lot of the boxes for fascism. Mm. But according to his Wikipedia and to a bunch of articles that I read, he was a Christian socialist.
He definitely
would not have used those words himself because the term socialist was still very negative back then. It seemed super foreign. It was tied to France and, like, you know, the Reds. It was
sure.
It was not something that you would say that you were if you wanted to be employed.
Yes.
So he instead identified as a nationalist, which is like,
That's very different from,
right?
Yeah.
By that, he meant that government nationalizes all the industries and uses the money to correct social ills.
Oh, my. Okay.
Right? Yeah,
that's A, not a nationalist, and B, that's...
No.
That's communism.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. In the book that I mentioned, Looking Backward, again, sounds like Fascism 101. Mm-hmm. It's a futuristic novel that's an indictment of capitalism in 1888.
Okay, sir. Yeah. It's that May 18th birthday that really...
Truly. You know. it revolutionized him.
Yes,
Not revolutionized him. What's the word? Radicalized him.
Yes,
yes.
There we go.
You have a radical birthday.
Radical.
So,
totally radical. You can't say radical. I say radical. That's my thing that I say.
That's my thing that I say. I love Milhouse. Oh, a gift. So this book that he wrote in 1888, it's a futuristic novel depicting a utopia in the year 2000. He believed by the year 2000, get this, we would be living in a collectivist society and there'd be no poverty and education would be free. And yeah, I want to read it because it was really popular at the... when it came out, I think it sold 1 million copies. Like, it was a huge novel. But yeah, he thought by the year 2000, we would have all had it together. I know.
You guys can't see my face.
Yeah.
Meh.
You can't hear Tux's face crinkle. So I don't want to make this guy sound like the best. He was, you know, he was a man.
Sure. Yes.
Okay. He was a man. He was a sexy man. but he was a man of his era. As such, his writing was tinged with eugenics. He was in those progressive circles that I talked about with the Buck v. Bell scandal that I did. People like Margaret Sanger were in that cohort. So he wrote that a democracy like ours cannot afford to throw itself open to the world where every man's a lawmaker. And he went on to say that every dull-witted or fanatical immigrant admitted to our citizenship is a bane to the Commonwealth. So he was looking for that right kind of immigrant. You know what I'm, you know, saying. His writings frequently mentioned inferior races, corrupted stock, talks of wholesome blood versus substandard blood. Yeah, just as I thought.
Yeah, trash.
Yeah, so I think here is a good spot for a little break, Sipu.
Yeah, I need to regroup. I need to collect myself. You, just hearing about this man has taken me on a complete journey.
Yeah, he was a man of contradictions. Yes. Like I went on many journeys with him.
I've just been sitting here going on a face journey.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I guess we'll be right back.
Yeah, BRB.
I'm Natalie.
And I'm Cass.
And we're the hosts of Shared History,
a comedic history podcast exploring the stories of the often overlooked or underrepresented.
The people and events your history books may have glossed over, whitewashed, man-washed, or left out completely.
From the Mayan creation myth to the Deaf President Now movement of the 1980s.
From ancient scientist Avicenna to first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller.
If you saw it in a footnote once,
or have never heard of it,
we are here to share it with you.
Join us in a rotating guest list featuring scholars, writers, teachers, entertainers, entrepreneurs, subject matter experts, and more.
Tune in to Shared History on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, you know the drill.
And follow us at Shared Pod on Instagram and Twitter.
And as always,
share you later.
We're back.
That we are.
With some fresh cocktails.
Mm-hmm. Old Robert Roy over here is doing us right. the Scottish,
not his whole government, Robert.
It was, what was it? Robert Roy McGregor, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I love a Manhattan. You know, what's funny. I was actually, when you told me like the era of your scandal and sort of gave me some hints about what it would be, I was looking at a lot of different options for cocktails and very briefly considered our first repeat cocktail.
Oh, what were you thinking about?
I was thinking about doing an old fashioned or a Manhattan, because I felt like they were like popular in all these different eras and also like super like sort of quintessentially American cocktails.
Yeah, there's so many cocktails out there.
That's
the
thing.
I don't think we need to repeat.
No, I know. And I did find one eventually, but I was having, it's been a very, it was a really stressful week. So I was like, oh, I don't have time to really dig in the way that I usually do. But I got there.
Yeah. And this is a great cocktail. I would have one of these. So after writing his really popular novel, Reverend Bellamy, he traveled to Massachusetts. In 1891, the good Reverend got a job. He accepted an offer at the Youth's Companion. Mm. So just a little bit of background on the Youth's Companion. It was a magazine that debuted in 1827. Early issues of what would later come to be called just The Companion. I'm like, okay, you guys, you're doing a lot, and also you're for kids. Like, you don't need to be trying to make it sophisticated. Uh-huh.
So like metropolitan.
Yeah, come on. Kids don't give a fuck. So in the beginning, they were just focusing on religion, which makes sense. That's why they hired Bellamy. Mm-hmm. But as a result of their focus, their circulation never reached over 5,000 copies a year. So they weren't doing very well.
Yeah.
This all would change when Bellamy started working there, because the CEO had a vision for getting coins. In 1892, Ford, the owner, he began a campaign to place American flags in every classroom in the country. Mm-hmm. Similar to Balch, the first pledge guy, Ford believed that the Civil War was still very fresh in the minds of a lot of Americans, and he thought that a great public show of patriotism targeted at children would help stabilize a fragile country.
Yeah.
And also help him secure the bag.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Both can be true.
Yeah. I mean, get that coin.
Yeah. Bellamy was put to work as a writer, because that's what he was, in the magazine's marketing department.
Okay.
He was part of a team tasked with creating patriotic programs for kids. When he arrived, there was already a marketing promo kind of in like a beta stage. They were trying to come up with a way of encouraging kids to buy more copies of the magazine by making it seem like everyone else was buying copies. Like, they had this program where for every 100 subscriptions, a school would get. Mm-hmm. So like you would buy a magazine and there would be a coupon in it that you were supposed to turn into your school. And if your school collected 100 of these little coupons, mm-hmm. then it would get a free flag for the school.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. It's in the industry, it's called GWP, a gift with purchase. It's a way to make people feel like they have this value add thing.
It's giving me the like box tops on cereal.
Yes. Yes.
Although I never fully understood.
Decoder rings was another thing that people... Oh, my mom still does box tops.
What are they for? I don't understand what they're for.
I have asked her this question. She's like, nothing. I don't know, but the school likes it. none of us are in school. I'm like, are you going to St. Paul's and giving them this? Mm-hmm. The answer is yes.
Oh my, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea what they're actually for. I also, do you remember that there was a time where people would like take the tab off the top of the soda can and collect them? I don't know. But we did it.
But who would collect in the school?
My grandmother. Okay. I guess for the school. I don't remember. Okay, I don't know.
The box tops definitely went to the school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know why. And like, I don't know. I need to look into this. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a mini this topic. Like, what the hell were they doing with those box tops?
Yeah.
We have a mini and I'm just interviewing my mom.
Oh my God. Yes, please.
Oh my God. My mom is hilarious. Anyways. So everyone knows that I'm home in Ohio right now. And our floors are really, really thin. And I like heard her laughing earlier today. And I'm like, what's going on down there? She just texted me back. I'm having fun. Okay.
Amazing.
Okay. Back to the story. So yes, they had this promotion where 100 little tickets or coupons would get a school a flag. And this program did amazingly well, like amazingly well. In a year's time, it was estimated that 30,000 flags had been purchased for schools, meaning that 3 million children had bought their little companion.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Up from 5,000.
Yeah, so that's...
They're doing
to
really,
get a
really
flag.
Well. Yeah. I mean, it was something, you know.
Sure.
Kids,
yeah.
I don't know. They're simple. All their little friends are getting their little coupons. They you know, they want it too. And these magazines were only 10 cents.
Okay.
So yeah, this program is doing really well. Educational papers were starting to talk about the movement. Teachers were talking about it at conventions, like, oh, you know, did your school get a flag? Oh, my school got a flag. It became this thing that was a huge hit. But the publisher wanted to go even further. With the anniversary, with the 400th year anniversary of the discovery of America, with that being the theme for the Chicago World Fair, Ford sought to align his magazine's drive, his like flag drive, with this celebration. He's like, is there a way for it to be linked? Like, can we get some promo action? The magazine called for a national public school celebration for Columbus Day. They wanted every kid on that day to, you know, have their flag because, you know, they bought 100 copies and they wanted them to recite a pledge. So they wanted this whole ritual to happen.
Sure.
So a flag salute was supposed to be part of this official program and assign the task of coming up with a short phrase or just, you know, like a poem basically that could be read when children were, I guess, looking at the flag.
Okay.
They were still, you know, they were still figuring it out. They didn't really like Balch's pledge of like, okay, this is not the tone we want. It's not really for kids. Like, kids, you know, don't really care about God and language like this dude did. Like, we need to find something that's updated, but like simple enough for children. So the pledge that Bellamy wrote, it was published in the September 8th issue of the magazine, and it was immediately put to use in the campaign. Bellamy was put in charge of the operation. He was a popular author, so just his name alone could open a lot of doors. He was able to get meetings with school superintendents, with government officials, and eventually he met with the president.
He met
with Benjamin Harrison.
Wow.
And he filled him in about this flag thing they had going and what they wanted. You know, they pitched their program, their vision for school children on, you know, what would eventually become Columbus Day. And Harrison agreed. And he declared Wednesday, October 12th, to be Columbus Day. And he made the Youth's Companion an official program for universal use in all schools. So schools were now being given copies. I don't think they were given flags. I think they would have to get their own flags. But it was coming from the president. So people, you know, people bought their flags to be ready for this event. So flash forward to today. Earlier this year, a tweet surfaced. This was just in March. A tweet surfaced with evidence that the youth's companion may have nicked the pledge from a child's entry into a patriotic competition 2 years earlier.
Oh my God.
Yeah. They stole the pledge from a child.
From a child. That's unbelievable. Oh my God.
Yeah. So a lot of my sources didn't have this new information. So I'm like, I'm going to save this like towards the end because this is like really salacious and delicious. Yeah. So there's this popular, he's like a contributor to the Oxford English Dictionary, a man named Barry Popick. He had the receipts. He tweeted his receipts and everyone's just like, wait, what?
Oh my God.
So he found a clipping from May of 1892. So the issue that had the pledge was in September. So this is in May. He found a newspaper clipping from Hayes, Kansas, of a school flag raising ceremony that mentioned an almost identical pledge. The 13-year-old Kansas schoolboy who wrote it, he also, his last name was Bellamy. His name was Frank Bellamy.
Weird.
Creepy, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, the simulation was breaking back then?
Yeah.
This is crazy. So this competition, the competition happened before Bellamy started working there, but the magazine just kept all of the entries. And it's interesting that it's referred to as the Bellamy Pledge, which, you know, technically isn't a lot.
Sure, yeah. Wild.
So this kid's pledge read, "I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation inseparable with liberty and justice for all." Bellamy's pledge read, "I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all."
Uh-huh.
Bitch changed one word.
One
inseparable word. To indivisible. Yeah.
What a coincidence. So, that they both came up with those completely separate from one another.
Yeah. Crazy, right? So a month after this magazine debuted on Columbus Day, it's estimated that 12 million American school children recited it in unison while standing in attention. What is often left out of this story is that there was a salute that went along with this pledge. Even though it's called the Bellamy Salute, it was invented by a man named James Upham. James Upham, I believe, was the cousin of the magazine owner. He was like a junior editor at the time. He was the head of the marketing department, so he was Bellamy's boss.
Okay.
So he had an idea of, he just wanted a ritual to go along with the flag. We have a flag, we have these words, but like we need an action. We need, like, you know, the hand over heart. We need some sort of thing to tie it all together.
Sure.
So the Bellamy salute, the instructions were, this is a quote, "At the signal from the principal, the pupils, in order of rank, hands to the side, face the flag. Another signal is given. Every pupil gives the flag the military salute. Right hand lifted, palm downward, to align with the forehead and close to it."
No, I don't like it.
It looks how you think it looks, you guys. It's the fascist salute.
Sig Heil.
Yeah. So it was called the Bellamy, you know, the Bellamy salute. And it was popular from the 1890s through the 30s. During the 20s and 30s, Italian fascists and Nazis in Germany, they kind of adopted a very curiously similar salute.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The Italians, they say that their fascist salute was an old Roman salute. But most historians call bullshit on that. The Romans weren't doing that. Mm-hmm. But from Italy, it spread to Germany. But the fact remains that the first people to be doing this pledge in mass were Americans. God.
No. I don't like
The only reason, you know, the only reason the Bellamy salute is not no longer used because, you know, people had eyes in the 30s. They're like, we can't keep doing this. This is a really bad look.
Yes.
This makes us look like we're fascists, you guys. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people started to fear that a picture of people pledging the flag would be taken out of context if the American flag wasn't visible, that they would think that, okay, these people are fascists.
Uh-huh, sure.
And there's actually a cropped photo of Charles Lindbergh doing the Bellamy salute that a lot of people attribute to him doing the Nazi salute. Yeah.
Uh-huh, okay.
Fun, right?
Yeah, that's interesting.
But it's like, I'll allow that crop because that's like,
I mean, he also was, yeah.
Tells the truth a little.
Exactly. I mean, America, well, whatever. I'm going to shut my mouth.
I'm going to take a sip.
We're the whole country wasn't that far from from acting like that back in those days.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, back to the pledge. No sooner than the pledge was written down than people just started messing with it, started changing words, starting adding to it. In 1923, the words "my flag" was changed to "the flag of the United States," because we didn't want immigrant children to be thinking that they're pledging their own flag.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I know. And I'm like, children aren't thinking this deeply. They're just saying it because their teacher said to do it. Like,
they literally thought
anything about this flag, really.
No, and like being a kid, it was just sort of something that we said without even really thinking about what it meant. Same. Or
yeah.
Sort of like saying like prayers out loud in church. Like, I never really, you know, I can recite the Lord's Prayer frontwards and backwards, but I never really thought about like what I was saying.
It's just proof that adults are thinking way too deep about this. Like, kids don't care. Kids aren't being like, I'm secretly pledging to the flag of Italy. Like, oh, they'll never know. Like, what? No. They're just saying it because they're being told to say it. Like,
and everybody else is doing it, so they're just doing it.
Exactly. It's not that deep. So, but the following year, the pledge was altered further. They added "of America," because before it was just the flag of the United States. So it's now we're up to the pledging allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Okay.
Which is, sidebar, isn't it weird that we pledge a flag and not the country itself?
Yeah. I mean, also, like, what other United States were we talking about here that we had to clarify the United States of America?
Again. Adults are being really stupid with this one. Yeah, there's no other United States at that point. And even now, like, what?
Yeah.
Come on. It's like, we should be pledging to the country, but whatever. We'll pledge this stupid flag because of, you know, because of marketing, whatever.
Yeah.
So in 1942, on the pledge's 50th anniversary, Congress adopted it as part of the National Flag Code. So now everyone needs to be doing this in schools. So this becomes part of the flag code. In the same flag code, they get rid of the Bellamy salute and they replace it with everyone is supposed to, instead of raising their right hand, palm facing forward, that you should put your right hand over your heart, other hand to the side.
Aww.
That's now the official, yes. All is the right response. So a decade later, Congress approved the addition of "under God" within the phrase "one nation indivisible."
What year again?
52.
52. Okay. Yeah. That tracks.
Eisenhower.
Yeah.
I might do a mini episode around some of the legal battles around that addition.
Sure.
Because I think it was the Jehovah's Witness people were the first people to say, like, no, we're not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids aren't doing this. Like,
good.
We're not. And they were the ones who were really pushing for exemptions, and they got it passed pretty quickly.
Mm.
In the end, Bellamy went on to work as an advertising executive. I mean, he was very good at it. He wrote extensively about the pledge later in his years, but there was nothing in his writing to suggest that he ever considered adding God to the pledge that he stole from that boy.
Yeah.
And he was a reverend. So what is everyone else's excuse?
Because, you know, communism, etc.
It's really dumb.
That's around the same time that we added "in God we trust" to our money, too. Because that didn't used to be on our money either.
Yeah.
Yeah. We added that later.
Yeah. You know, communists are atheists. You know, they're going to take over.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason why we have flags are because this one magazine's numbers were down and they needed.
That's so funny.
Right? Isn't it so good? I always thought the reason we had flags in schools was some government initiative, but no, it was private business.
History is so fucking weird sometimes. Like,
right?
The idea of the like butterfly effect It seems so ridiculous when you try and think of it like the beginning of it. But something like this, that's like so weird and small and insignificant, having such a huge impact on like millions of people's lives for a century to come.
This magazine is why we are obsessed with Flax.
It's nuts.
This one little magazine for children.
Yeah.
Like it's, yeah. When I found this story, so I learned about the Bellamy Pledge, and then I like, you know, I made a story around it. So I had no clue that this was all just marketing. That's so wild. Yeah. I don't know what I thought, but I was delighted when I started researching it because I'm like, this is a fun story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, America, the United States of America.
Don't you know?
Not to be confused with those other United States.
Yes. Not my flag, but the flag.
Yes. I'll just stick with kids not my flag.
Kids are just thinking about flags all day because that's what, you know, what's going on in the streets. So yeah. Silly. Absurd.
Kids these days. They will cluck their tongues.
What is that from?
Homer? It's some episode where he tries to get into like a country club or something. I can't remember exactly how it goes down.
Yeah. I remember just a really long, like, yeah, soliloquy.
Yes. I don't know all the words to that one, unlike the so I tied an onion to my belt, which was the style at the style time. That's it. Oh, I have a little tiny bit left of my cocktail. Let me.
Oh, I done.
Done. You know, I'm proud of you. Cherry. Cherry's the best part.
Yeah, I didn't have any cherries. Oh. I could have got cherries. I forgot.
The good ones are expensive, and then, you know.
I think they did have them at the store, and I wasn't even thinking.
But they're like 20 bucks a jar for the Luxardos.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Oh, well, then I would not have bought them.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Anyways, now our drinks are empty because I did it. I got there.
Finally.
So yeah, America's history is juicy. We just add Scotch whiskey and sweet vermouth. You know, name it after Scottish Robin Hood. No big deal.
I love it.
So yeah, thank you guys so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Thank you to our new audio editor, Dev. We could not do this without him. That's it.
He's the best.
That he is. Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Thanks for listening. Bye. Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note that we are not historians. We're just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media and make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. And we also have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.